Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 112 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. I started my journey into the Middle Ages through literature, learning the concrete history as a way of understanding the stories that were being told at the time. But what really pulled me into the history and made me want to spend my time on it was some amazing primary sources that I had no idea existed. I encountered a bunch of these in my undergraduate courses, but there was one that hooked me right from the start, the Trotula. A collection that brings together social history, medical history, and women's history, the Trotula was a recent translation at the time I first encountered it, but it's one that's had a huge impact on how historians view all of these things in the years since. So in honor of the 20th anniversary of this edition of the Trotula, I invited its editor and translator, Dr. Monica Green, to speak with me about this amazing work. Monica is an independent scholar and one of the world's leading experts on medieval medical history, especially women's medicine and the Black Death. She's also one of the most prolific authors and researchers in our field, with well over 200 credits to her name, including her books, Making Women's Medicine Masculine, The Rise of Male Authority in Premodern Gynecology, and Women's Healthcare in the Medieval West. As an authority on pandemic disease, Monica's work is helping us better understand not only the Black Death, but also COVID-19. So of course, I did ask her about that at the end of the interview. But the focus of today's podcast is the Trotula. So here's our conversation on Trota, the Trotula, women's medicine in the medieval period, and how detailed research can help us better understand the mysteries of the medieval world. But thank you so much for joining me, Monica, to talk about the 20th anniversary of the Trotula. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you and to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for asking me. This is a great delight to be here today.
It's so great to have you. And I do want to congratulate you not only on the anniversary, but you've just got a prize that's been created in your name at the Medieval Academy of America. So let me just read their blurb. It says the Monica H. Green Prize for Distinguished Medieval Research will be awarded annually for a distinguished project that shows the value of medieval studies in our present day. So congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That is a really tremendous honor. And one of the things I like about it best is that it's not creating more work for me. It's recognizing and supporting and uplifting the work of others, which is really wonderful to see.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone who's come across your scholarship knows how hard you work. You can take a break and let other people stand on your shoulders for once. Okay, so we're here to talk about the Trotula, which honestly is one of my favorite books in medieval studies. I came across it as an undergraduate many years ago, and I just really enjoy it, not only because it's an intersection between social history, medical history, and textual history, but it's also just a really great work of scholarship that shows your attention to detail. So let's get into it. What is the Trotula?
What is the Trotula? Answering that question was the work of over 12 years of scholarship. And even the fact that you can say the Trotula is a function of the success of my work. Mm-hmm. Because what had been the state of affairs when I was a wee graduate student was that Trotula was assumed to be the name of a woman. And the quick story is that the Trotula is an ensemble of three different texts, almost certainly by completely different authors, but probably all three coming, in fact, certainly all three are coming out of southern Italy in the 12th century. Okay, so they have a common origin. They're all on the same topic of talking about women's medicine, so obstetrics, gynecology, but also cosmetics. And towards the end of the 12th century, somebody, we have absolutely no idea who, put them together. Just said, okay, here is these three texts. Let me just kind of line them up one after the other. And we will call it the Liber qui dicitur Trotula. That's Latin for the book, which is called the Trotula. And Trotula here is a diminutive form of the name Trota, which is well documented as a woman's name in Salerno, this town in southern Italy that was very famous as a medical center. So Trotta is a historically documentable woman. She, however, is only associated with the middle of those three texts. So that text, in some form or another, was circulating under her name. We're not even sure that she wrote it. It might be something closer to teachings of her that they were written down. And in fact, in the earliest forms of the text, it has three English words in it. This is a Latin text that actually has three English words in it. So there's some connection here between the Normans in England and what's going on with the Normans in southern Italy. But anyway, it's complicated in a actually delightful way. But the thing is that the name, the word Trotula, originated as a title. And then by the time we're getting into the 13th century, people don't remember. It's more than 100 years since the genesis of these texts. And Trotta, Trotula, people don't quite see what the difference is. And so they start referring to an authoress of the whole group of texts, which they now are thinking is just one text. They refer to her as Trotula. And so when we get, you know, jumping ahead to the 14th century, when we get to Chaucer, he mentions Trotula along with Eloise as an authority on women in the prologue to The Wife of Bath's Tale. So anyway, so that's how Trotula becomes understood as a woman's name, as the name of an authoress, and as the name of this group of texts, which no longer is really understood to be a group of three separate texts, but just one text. Then we jump ahead to the Renaissance, and the Renaissance editors are cleaning up these medieval texts, and they actually think the Trotula is an ancient text, and it's been garbled by the barbarian Latinity of the Middle Ages. And so they clean it up, and they say, well, look at this. There's this redundancy. It's like this one section of the text is talking about, you know, kind of uterine pain. And then later in the text, it returns to talking about uterine pain. Let's put them together. And let's put them, all the sections on menstruation, we'll put those together. And all the sections on cosmetics, we'll put all of that together. So the Renaissance editor creates the text that he thinks should have existed in the first place and still is talking about Trotula as being authored. Then somebody else comes along and says, no, wait a minute, Trotula must be an error. It must be Eros. Eros, who wrote this, so this great physician to the Empress Julia. So it becomes an ancient text by a male author. And then basically from that point on, so we're talking about 1544, 1566, when these interventions are being made. From that point on, there will be debates in scholarly literature about who is Trotula, did Trotula exist, was Trotula a woman, and what is this text about? And so I came along in graduate school and I was like, I don't care whether it's written by a woman or not. I want to know. I was in training in the history of science program. And I want to know, what does this text say? What does it actually have to say about female physiology? About how do they think the female body actually works? Because your conceptions of physiology are the foundation of any therapeutic system. Because if you're going to make medical interventions, then you're making medical interventions to somehow complement or counteract the way that you think the body is supposed to work when it's healthy. So, and that was, in fact, the title of my dissertation was something, 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 the history of female physiology and disease from the ancient world to the early Middle Ages. And so that was the question that I had. But I got into it thinking, this is a single text. It's a single text by a single author. Why are there these contradictory statements? So anyway, I made the best use I could of the version that I was using. So I was using just the Renaissance text at the time because I hadn't had training in manuscript work. I was probably not until maybe my second or third summer of graduate school that I actually had a course in paleography. I was just making a mess of things. but I knew that there was some real problems. Anyway, I ended up deciding, okay, I'm going to do my dissertation on everything up to the Trotula, surveying medical ideas about female physiology and disease up through the Trotula. So starting with the ancient Greeks and so forth. And the thing was this, is that one of the other things that was said about the Trotula was that it was written before Constantine the African was active. So Constantine the African, he's another figure that I have been working on for a long time and will continue to work on. Constantine the African is a translator, and he is someone who comes from North Africa, from Islamic North Africa, and goes to Italy and brings all of these medical books with him and ends up spending the rest of his life translating the Arabic medicine into Latin. That becomes the foundation of the rest of Western medicine. Mm-hmm. Absolutely astounding, the work that he did and the impact that he had. Constantine marks a real divide in Western medicine. There's Arabic medicine, and then there's before Arabic medicine. And the people who had looked at the Trotula thought, oh, there's nothing of Arabic medicine in here. Therefore, she must have lived before Constantine. And so I was assuming, I started the dissertation thinking that this is just going to reflect Latin medicine. So all I have to do is look at the early medieval Latin texts, reconstruct a history of writings about women's medicine in the early Middle Ages in Latin. At the same time I was doing this work, another medievalist, John Benton, who was out at Caltech, he was also working on the Trotula, and he had actually been collecting the manuscripts and was comparing them to the Renaissance edition. And what he realized was that the manuscripts didn't look anything like the Renaissance edition, because the Renaissance editor had done all of this, rejigging and renovation of the text. And so he started to say, well, wait a minute, what do we find in the medieval text? And what we find in the medieval text is three separate texts. And he assumed there's three separate texts. None of them have anything to do with Trotula, and it's not even clear that Trotula exists. Wait a minute, and this was his big discovery. In a Madrid manuscript, he found a completely different text that was actually labeled Practica Secundum Trotam, the practical medicine according to Trota. Again, it's a completely different text, and he looks at it and he says, oh, there is a Trota. There is a real woman. Her name is Trota, and here is her text. Here's the Trotula, which is completely different, and therefore they must be completely different phenomena. What I found after I took over the project, he died in 1988. After I took over the project, what I realized was that, in fact, Trotta's authentic work was, in fact, part of that center text in the Trotula ensemble. So the appellation, the Trotula, was, in fact, truthful when it was originally applied. The text did have some association with her. Oh, the other thing that I can't even remember now, whether it was Benton himself who figured it out, if I figured it out, if we both figured it out. But one of the other texts, or the first text in the group, contrary to previous opinion, was based on Constantine's work. In fact, it was very heavily based on Constantine's work. So my initial idea that I could ignore the Arabic transmission of ideas about female physiology and disease went out the window. So I really just kind of had to rejig the ambitions of the dissertation. So anyway, as I said, Benton died and I took over the Trotula project and just decided, okay, we need a new edition from scratch. The Renaissance thing is just completely unreliable. It's distorted, and we have to get back in touch with something. And so what that work did was having me look at basically all the manuscripts that I could find of the text. So Benton had already collected a lot of them. He'd collected microfilms or reproductions of them. And I spent years traveling to libraries all over Europe, looking at others and, you know, making collations and so forth. So anyway, it was a long project. So even though we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the publication of it, the origin of the project goes back a lot further.
Well, I really commend you for taking the time to pull this apart, because as you've said, and you go through it in the introduction, it's been so changed, altered, edited things have been added, subtracted over the years that it really took a lot of work for you to pull this into three different texts and see how they go together. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talk about in the introduction is this is very much a product, if we look at the collection of three texts, very much a product of time and place, because, well, what's going on in Salerno in the 12th century that makes this very much a product of its time?
That's what I'm trying to still figure out. After I wrote the introduction to the Trotula, this is basically as soon as I finished the Trotula, this next project got onto my desk, and it's been there ever since, which is what's going on at Salerno in the 12th century. So there's actually quite a bit of scholarship about Salerno, but I realized that my edition of the Trotula was one of the first times a critical edition of a Salernitan text was being done. There were other Salernitan medical texts that had been published, but basically somebody would just say, oh, I happen to have this manuscript here, let me transcribe it. And that is useful. You know, any manuscript is the testimony from the past, but it doesn't really give us any sense of the development of the text. And the more I was realizing about what I understood about Salerno was that we didn't have our chronology well worked out. We didn't have kind of the traditions of who was a master and who was a student of that master and how various things developed. And so I had spent 12 years editing the Trotula. As I said, I was collecting information and in many cases reproductions of every single manuscript that I knew about. That was 122 manuscripts, I think, when I went to press with the book. There's 148 that I know about now. I mean, and that's how things work, especially with a popular text. You're just going to keep finding more and more copies. And so I decided, okay, no way can I do this. Can I commit myself to editing these other Salernitan texts? However much they need to be edited, that's not something that I can do by myself. So what I'm going to do is do a project where I'm looking at all of the manuscripts that seem to date from the 12th century. And so I defined a long 12th century. So going back and scooping up the last quarter of the 11th century and then overreaching and grabbing the first quarter of the 13th century. So about 150 years. And I'm just going to look through every catalog I can, any manuscript I'm in. I'm going to see if I can have a look at anything that seems to be medicine in Latin that's looking like it's part of this long 12th century. That list counts almost 600 manuscripts now. That's how huge the project has been. But the goal of the project was precisely to do what I've done, which is to take a snapshot, not to predetermine what was important, but just to say, look at the evidence that exists and then sort it out. So the evidence here and the criterion, of course, is the approximate date of the manuscripts, which is determined on paleographical grounds for the most part. What does medicine in the 12th century look like? So your question is, what did Salerno look like? What Salerno looks like to me now is Salerno is just one piece of a bigger puzzle, that already there was a lot of medical activity that started at Monte Cassino, which is where Constantine was. But it wasn't only what was going on at Monte Cassino wasn't only translating Arabic into Latin. That was just one part of it. It seems either at Monte Cassino or at some affiliated house, they were also translating from Greek into Latin. So remembering now what Southern Italy, so kind of the whole boot of Southern Italy and Sicily has been under Arab control since the 9th century. Sicily has remained this depot of international commerce throughout this period. Sicily has also remained home to Greek-speaking populations who have been there ever since the Byzantine period, even before that. So Greek is still thriving on Sicily. Arabic is thriving on Sicily. And then the Normans come in, starting about 1060 or so, and start retaking parts of Italy. And by the 1090s, the conquest of Sicily is complete, and the Normans have complete control. So what the Normans are doing is they're coming down as these Norsemen and stirring up the pot in southern Italy. And that's what we see in medicine. Things that, texts that probably have just kind of been sitting in some monastery for decades or maybe even centuries get rediscovered. And somebody says, oh, I need to copy this. Oh, I need to translate this. What Salernitan medicine looks like now is a lot of all of these things, because Constantine really is a powerhouse. I mean, I'm just, the more I learn about him, the more I am in awe of what he did. Is he's basically just saying, no, we need to clean up the pharmaceutics. We need a single way of talking about the measurement of drugs and how we're going to mix drugs and how we're going to understand the properties of drugs. With the gynecology, before Constantine translates his Viaticum, which has chapters on women's medicine, and that becomes the foundation for the first part of the Trotula. Before that, there is this effort to reclaim these early Latin texts, the Cleopatra and Muscio, and to reclaim this new text that's, I think, just recently been translated. It's in the Greek, it's attributed to a female author, Metrodora. In the Latin version, it doesn't have an attribution, but they're busy. They're busy. I mean, this is, they're creating out of, you know, little, you know, bits and pieces that they're putting together. They're creating five new texts on women's medicine. And then we have the Trotula texts that get created in the 12th century. Again, the first text is on the basis of Constantine's Viaticum. Trata is an unicum. Trata just kind of comes out of nowhere, and she has all of these practices. She is not literate. And I mean that in two senses. One, I'm not in fact sure that she wrote down the things that we have written down. They might have been written down before her, which would not be unusual. But the other thing is that she's not intertextual. She won't quote Galen. She won't quote Hippocrates. There's no evidence that she's read those other texts. She is the ultimate empiricist. Said, this is what I do, and this is how I do it. And I'm not even going to explain how it works because, you know, I don't do that theory stuff. And then there's the text on women's medicine, which is written by, I think, a male who goes to, down to Sicily and starts observing the cosmetic procedures of Muslim women on Sicily. So that's what's going on with the Trotula, with women's medicine. And then there's just a proliferation of texts on pharmacy. There's a proliferation of texts on theory, a practica. So Trata, I've already mentioned, she wrote a practical medicine, but so do these other Salernitan masters. And the amazing thing, and this is, again, part of the work that Benton did originally, was there's this text that we only have, we had one copy. It was destroyed in World War II. It's called The Treatment of Diseases. And what somebody did was they took seven Salernitan masters, the different practical texts, so their writings on, you know, basically kind of medical encyclopedias, and then created a super encyclopedia where he took, I think if I'm remembering, or maybe it's Platyarius, probably Platyarius's text, is kind of the main thing that he just kind of plugs in the excerpt. It's a really cut and paste job. He plugs in Platyarius's text, and then he adds bits and pieces from these other masters. Trata is called quasi magistra, as if she were a master.
I love that.
And in this manuscript, and we have a couple of incredibly precious photographs of it, and then there was, it was transcribed multiple times, so it wasn't like it was completely lost. But when they're introducing the other, so often, not always, but often in the margin, the scribe will say, indicate whose text a passage comes from. And what he does is he puts M. Plat or M. Yo. So M. Platyarius, Magister Platyarius, Magister Johannes, Magister. When he's indicating the excerpts from Trata, he never puts the M. He never gives her that last acknowledgement of expertise. He'll use her stuff all over the place. That text is an amazing resource for reconstructing her writings, but he just won't go there with acknowledging her as a master. It's really just fascinating. So, and then the other thing that's going on is this is all happening in southern Italy, but this is the Normans who are on top. There, I mean, it's a colonial environment here. The Normans are then sending copies of all these things up north. And so, and this was, again, one of the things that I never would have figured out unless I was doing all of this work directly with the manuscripts. The earliest copies of the Trotula text, or the copies that preserve the earliest form, so maybe a 14th century copy, but it's clearly replicating a 12th century form of the text, they're all in England. They're all in England. That's how quickly this Salernitan text. And if you look at, you know, Marie de France and various other writers of this period, you will see. I mean, that's how a lot of the lore about Salerno got started, was because these other writers of the period know what the reputation of Salerno is in the period. And so that's a big part of why Trotula got to be as famous as she did, is this is an incredible PR machine that she's part of. So she is known. We can honestly say that she had an international reputation in the 12th century. And then that just, you know, continues on into the later periods. And again, just to reiterate, I could not have worked out any of this if I hadn't done all of the manuscript work, piecing, you know, every piece together and tracking it in terms of when it shows up, where it shows up, and what it reflects about the larger textual tradition.
Yeah, because everything is connected. We were talking about this before we started recording, everything being connected. Now, I did want to ask you, this is related to all the things we're talking about now. I think a lot of people come to your book, your Trotula, to find out what's going on with women's medicine at this time. And one of the things that you mentioned is that Trotula seems to be an anomaly in that she's a woman and her stuff is written down. It's not very often that this happens. But do you think that this, that her text, especially its basis in not on theory, but on practical work, do you think that gives us a picture of the type of medicine that women were practicing at this time? Because we know that women were practicing somewhat. Do you think that the Trotula gives us a window onto that?
Yes and no. I'm overall a pessimist. I'm not simply a person, a glass half full. I'm the kind of person that questions the existence of water. And so, as I've explained to you, I didn't go into all of this work trying to answer the question, was this written by a woman or not? That it's not even secondary. It was of tertiary importance at best. But I knew it was a question that when I went into the classroom, my students would want an answer to. I know that's a question that people who pick up that book want an answer to. I did, as I said, come to the opinion, disagreeing with Benton, that the middle text, the De Cures Mulierum on treatments for women, is to be associated with Trotula and represents her method of practice, even if she cannot be called the author. And one of the problems there is that she's actually cited in the third person, like within the text. So I never kind of came to a completely satisfactory resolution of how to explain that. But once I had that text cordoned off, and I could see, I mean, again, then the manuscript tradition is amply confirmatory of this. This is a unique text, and it circulated by itself for a while before it got absorbed into the Trotula. So we can say, what is distinctive about this text? And what I found, and it blew me away when I found this, is comparing that to the first text called Conditions of Women, which, again, derived from Constantine's Viaticum and other sources, what I could say was, this is women's medicine. This is someone that she is using the first person plural most of the time. We do this. We do that. We apply. We insert. And what I found when I was reading other, and I basically read, this was other work, but it was partly to contextualize the Trotula. I looked at every medieval text on women's medicine, every single one of them. That was in my 2000 book that came out just before the Trotula, is I have an appendix there where I list every single medieval European text on women's medicine, no matter the language in which it was written. And I went through all of them too. You know, the basic initial question was, is this Dutch text, Hebrew text, whatever it was, is it a translation of the Trotula? So part of it was just establishing the circulation of the Trotula. But again, I wanted to look at all the things. And anyway, so it's about 150 texts. Maybe a third of them we can say who the author is. All men. all men. I have never to this day found another woman who's writing specifically on women's medicine, aside from excerpts that you can find in Hildegard of Bingen's writings. Mm-hmm. And those passages aren't necessarily strictly therapeutic. So this text by Trotha really is an unicum. It's a unique text. But what I found, comparing it to all these other male-authored texts, is when the male author writes about applying something or inserting something, I mean, it's just this amazing, it's universal, this grammatical flip of let this be done. Yeah. It's the jus of subjunctive that we call it in Latin. Let this be done. Let this be inserted. Let this be applied. When you're reading Trotha, it's we do this. And this is one of the most amazing passages in the entire document, where she's describing fistula repair. Fistula, of course, is when the flesh that is supposed to separate the vagina from either the bladder or the anus gets ripped, usually in childbirth. And especially it happens in women who are bearing children very young, which would probably have been normative for women at this time. She says, we sew.
Yes. Yeah.
Take a silk thread and we sew the tear, and then we apply pitch to cover up the wound and let it heal. I still remember this. Again, because I'm looking at all the manuscripts, I'm looking for any hint that is going to discredit the ideas that I was coming to. But no, it was just like every single early copy of this text was 100% consistent on using that direct grammatical formulation. And so that's essentially what I came down to, is this is women's medicine. It is the medicine practiced by individuals who are allowed, who are socially allowed direct access to the genitalia of other women. That means there are women. What was also amazing, frankly, was how relatively rarely those passages were rewritten, even when you knew that the text was being made for or copied by male scribes.
You mean like grammatically rewritten to say, let it be done?
Yeah. So I was looking for those, and which, actually, you could be cynical and say that shows how little attention they're paying.
I suppose.
Medicine. But anyway, that was really striking. So that was what the analysis that I did on Trotha's OBGYN writings. Then after I published the text of the Trotha in 2008, so it took another 7 years to get this other book done, was my big cultural history of the Trotha and women's medicine in general in the Middle Ages and into the early modern period. I asked the question, why were there no other Trothas?
Mm-hmm.
So we can say, yes, Trotha is amazing. It's astounding that, a woman can be writing these things, articulating these things, offering these kinds of treatments for women, that it's being passed up to, presumably Norman courts in northern France and England. But why weren't there more? Why can't we find other women like this? Why can't we find other texts? And that was the sad thing. And again, this is where I get back to my pessimism, which was in my The second book that came out in 2008 is called Making Women's Medicine Masculine. And my argument is that even though women's literacy is rising, and I said before, I am still not entirely sure that Trotha herself was literate. She may have done all the things she did and just had an amanuensis write those things down to her. But we have plenty of other evidence from other sources about women in courts, about nuns, et cetera, of women's literacy in the Middle Ages. My question is, and this was kind of another study that I spent like 4 years researching, I wanted to answer the question, how often, even among women who we know were literate, who we know owned books, how often did they own medical texts? Mm-hmm. No, so if you asked any woman now, do you own medical texts? They might say immediately no, but then they say, well, wait a minute, don't you own, this handbook of, how to handle your menstrual periods, or don't you own this thing on menopause? You will not find a single woman who doesn't have some medical literature in her collection for self-care. So I went through every kind of source I could find to see, okay, we know this woman owned books. Here's a list of the books, the inventory at her death. Are there any medical books? And I have included tables in that publication. It was like a 77-page article or something. I included all of this information that I found. And what I found was a really tiny number of women could be documented. Maybe they had recipes that they were writing in the back of their books. That's kind of a whole different research project. Somebody else has to do it. of going through books of hours, for example.
Right, yeah.
Seeing, okay, are there recipes? You know, is that a place? So these are, again, books that we know women owned. Are they medicalizing them in some way or another? But basically, that was my overall argument of that second book. Actually, it was my third book. Men take over medicine. Medicine is professionalizing in all kinds of ways. I mean, university training in medicine is a function of the high Middle Ages. Licensing for medicine is a function of the high Middle Ages. You know, textbooks, so many other things are professionalized in this sense. And that it's not simply in the universities, it's that there's a professionalization practice that happens among surgeons as well, most of whom are not associated with universities. Does that same professionalization happen for midwives? Is there a class of women that we can identify? And again, scattered across the scene, we can find women in medical practice. Medicine is often a family business. The father is, you know, master of his surgery shop, and he's training his sons. Does the wife contribute to the work of the household? In very many cases, yes. But when the master dies, who does he pass his books on to?
Right.
Their sons. And what I found was, in terms of talking about women's medicine, as I said, I had already established the grammatical distancing of when men are writing about women's medicine. Mostly they're recycling textual information that they've gotten from other texts. There's very little originality in it. And then also this grammatical distancing. The exception is fertility. So fertility is, in most senses of how to treat fertility, is you're seeing it as basically a physiological problem. And you need to tell people how to change their diet, how to change their daily regimen, that they need to sleep more, they need to have sex less. They, you know, whatever it is you're telling them, it will be on that level of regimen. Who controls advice about regimen? Male physicians. And if there's need for any surgical interventions because of, you know, an odd conformation of the genitalia or something, that will be male surgeons that are involved. And so males take over authority, authoritative stance over fertility concerns. Then what happens, and it seems to be after the Black Death, is that all limitations are off. It's just like, oh, cesarean section, we can do that. not on a living woman. Cesarean section is not a living woman. It's not to save the mother's life. It's basically to extract the fetus so you can either baptize it or kind of essentially register it as the legal heir. It's not even that you necessarily intend for the fetus to survive. But basically, in the late Middle Ages, you've seen all this new involvement of men in women's medicine and a new kind of originality. And by the 16th century, it's complete that women's medicine is now a masculine field of expertise. So the gist of my argument is essentially that even though women are becoming increasingly literate in the late Middle Ages, that literacy doesn't get channeled over into this kind of expertise in this field. There may still be many exceptions to those generalizations. Another thing, this is just another sobering fact. So I said I had been looking for every copy of the Trotula. And so I'd been chasing down not simply the Latin copies, but also the vernacular translations. And one of the questions I asked was, does vernacularization equate with feminization? When a text is translated out of Latin, is it because you want it to go to a female audience? Well, sometimes that seems to be the case. And well, it's two kinds of evidence. It's both the prefaces of saying, I'm writing this, I'm translating this so that women can read it. but also what I also did was codicological studies. Look at the text as it survives in the book copy and say, is this the kind of text that a woman would use? If we know it was owned by a man, as is, you know, normally the case, then there's some real questions that can be asked about. I mean, yes, maybe the women in his household also used it, but it gets really messy. I had to go. But one of the things I was looking for, can I prove that any woman owned the Trotula? I had to go to the 16th century to a German copy, German translation of the Trotula before I found a documentable woman owner of the Trotula.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's a censorship thing? Because these are delicate issues? Because they're like the Middle Ages is not so delicate as later ages.
Oh, well, no, they're also, yeah, I haven't even started on that. Another analysis I did, which is the ways in which the female figure Trotula and the Trotula texts become seen sources of women's secrets.
Yeah, yeah.
Which pretty much equates to issues of reproduction and sexuality. I think I have it embedded in a footnote somewhere. And it's one of those things that I always meant to get back to and publish. And yeah, life gets in the way. There's a very small textual tradition. There's only just two or three manuscripts that have this, where Trotula is not simply a female authoress, but she has a daughter also named Trotula. And mother and daughter are prostitutes.
Oh, wow.
And they go around and disseminate this information about women's medicine. It's bizarre and so forth. So there's ways in which Trotula is appropriated in various kinds of ways. And in many of those cases, again, I was looking at the codicological patterns. In many of those things where either the title Secrets of Women is applied to it or for other reasons, it really just gets out of a medical context altogether. And it's either in kind of a natural philosophical context where it's being found with treatises on sermons, a bad exemplum of sexuality that needs to be lectured to the populace. And again, somebody else may find a cache of information that has escaped me thus far. But again, I have no evidence that it's women.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I think that people have tended to say that much of women's medicine was an oral tradition, and it seems like this might be borne out.
Well, this is part of the argument that I made in that book, is that if women's medicine had to stay an oral tradition, think about the ways in which women as patients were impoverished because of that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And what I mean by that is this. It's not to dismiss hands-on knowledge. It's not to dismiss the really phenomenal knowledge that any practitioner will gain from watching a dozen births, 100 births. There is a normalness of the birth process. But what I find significant is when it's not normal, when something goes wrong, when the fetus malpresents in the uterus, when the placenta is badly positioned and breaks or is obstructed. These are dire, dire situations. If that technical specialist knowledge is not being passed down among women because they don't write books and they don't own books and they don't read books, what does that mean for the quality of care that women are getting generation after generation after generation? And that's one of the things that you do see once you move into the early modern period, is you see a proliferation of texts for midwives. And there again, there's still some debate about, are these even written? Even the ones that say they're written by women, are they written by women? But we know that they are scooped up by midwives, by practicing midwives, who in many cases are now licensed. So there is a transition to, I don't know if you can say universal licensing, but pretty widespread licensing of midwives by the time we get to the 16th century. So there is an expectation of basic knowledge that midwives are supposed to have. And then really, once you get a text that's circulating among them, that becomes both a badge of professionalism, but also becomes a foundation for collecting knowledge and collecting that specialist knowledge, collecting that knowledge of the special case. That builds up the discipline. And what I see, and I think I made this statement somewhere in the book, I see at least a minimum 200-year gap between that process of collecting specialist knowledge as it happens in surgery versus when it happens for women. Not surgery in general, but surgery on the male genitalia. So there are special techniques of, you know, hernia repair and so forth. That it, clearly there are specialists. There are actually traveling specialists who go around from time to time. You know, you have anybody with hernias in town? Here we're here for, you know, a few weeks, a couple months. We'll take care of them. That level of specialization happened for male we can call it andrological conditions, 200 years before it happened for women. That's what gender is for me. That's what gender is. It's different access to power, knowledge, and the benefits that might come. So overall, the work on the trochila, both the, you know, the textual work that I did, but also the cultural history work, was very sobering for me. I did not come out of this work happy. So even, you know, even having established, yes, there was this one woman that we can look at and point to and say, you know, these are at least undocumented achievements that she made. The fact that there aren't other trotas is the part that makes me sad.
Yeah, I completely understand that. And I'm really hoping, as you say, that maybe someone will discover a treasure trove that has possibly been missed. Let's hold out some hope.
Well, I have to say that two scholars who are continuing to do work, which is just amazing. And, you know, I just live in breathless anticipation of them publishing their work. They're both in Spain. Carmen Caballero Navas, who is working on Hebrew texts on women's medicine, and Montserrat Cabré, who's working, she has discovered a new Catalan translation that the author, and this is just amazing, the author has actually understood that trota is separate from trotula.
Wow.
Yeah. It will just be absolutely wonderful when those studies are published.
Oh, we'll have to look forward to that.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I'm so glad that you put in all that 12 years of effort to bring the trochula to the forefront. And I do want to mention something that we talked about before we started recording, that Monica has written the Wikipedia articles on both trochula and trota. So before you look anywhere else for your information, you can go to Wikipedia, you can see her work, it's listed. And of course, we're going to have all of your scholarship, a link for people in a moment. I can't let you go without asking you. So you are one of the world's foremost experts on the Black Death. Here we are. We are a year into COVID. Is there anything you want to tell people now that you have a platform, another platform, to tell people about what we need to think about in terms of the Black Death and COVID? I know it's something to spring on you, but I can't let you go without asking.
I'm involved in a project that's called How Epidemics End. And I'm actually overdue with my essay to send to them, but what I'm going to be talking about is actually how pandemics end. And the answer is, for the most part, they don't. What I have found frightening to watch this past year and a half is the comfortable assumption that, oh, well, all of these old diseases are gone, therefore this will be gone too. And that can come from a variety of different stances. It's, you know, comes from people who are anti-masking. It comes from people who are anti-vax. It was also come from people who are pro-vax and say, okay, well, the vaccine will fix everything and then everything will be fine. And then, you know, we can go out and play again. And look at the world. Look at the state of the world right now. The vaccines have been fully available for over 6 months now. There are many countries that still have no vaccination programs that are in place. And there are many countries where even the limited vaccination process that has already begun is completely insufficient. We are so ignorant of what pandemics are. We are so ignorant of how we've actually controlled them, if we have controlled them at all. The story with smallpox is essentially a story of luck. Luck on a variety of levels. Luck in stumbling upon a basic vaccine formula that works. Luck in having a disease that differed from COVID-19 in that somebody who was afflicted was visibly afflicted. So there's not hidden carriers. There's not that hidden transmission for the most part. If someone has smallpox, a child can point to them and say that person has smallpox. And that was one of the big factors in the elimination of smallpox, is they enlisted children. this is 100% serious about the ways in which smallpox was a very special disease, and it offered ways of containment that most other diseases don't. We're going to be living with COVID for a long time. We could have killed COVID off, I think, by February of last year, and we didn't. But I think one of the things about the response generally is people didn't take it seriously enough. And my work on the history of infectious diseases has been screaming to me for years, we need to take these new infectious diseases seriously, because once we lose control over them, it may take us hundreds of years to obtain any real control over them. So that's the one thing that I would like people to know. And the fact of the matter is that my ability to say this comes from the fact that I have been working on the second plague pandemic, which we now understand to be 600 years long. Yeah. Continual transmission of related strains of plague that starts in the 13th century and continues for another 600 years. That's how long you can lose control. And the thing is that we're not even sure that the things that we think controlled it, like quarantines, actually really was what controlled it, rather than just genetic decay of the organism. Those are questions that are still under debate right now. So,
yeah,
yes, as I said, I'm a bit of a pessimist.
No, I think that you were right in all of the warnings that you gave at the beginning of this. I remember them. And I think people need to look at your work, and they need to look at the way you work, which is by working with people in other fields and bringing together the knowledge you have from history to scientists and working together to find solutions. So I'm delighted to meet you, because I really admire your work in the work on the Trotula, the work on the Black Death. And it's just such a pleasure to have you here. Even if you're a pessimist, that's great. It's still nice to meet you.
Okay.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
To find out more about Monica's work, you can check out her page at independentscholar.academia.edu/Monica H. Green. Or you can follow her on Twitter at Monica Med Hist. That's MONICA. MEDHIST. The Trotula is, of course, a book that I highly recommend. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey. We've got a couple of things to tell you about. One is this interesting research that was done. It was done a few years ago, but it's about newspapers, medieval newspapers. And the thinking has been that they only kind of came around in like the early modern period in Europe, but there's quite a lot of evidence about newspapers existing in 12th and 13th century China. It's really kind of fascinating. There is kind of government-run newspapers, which gives you all the kind of official information. And then there are what they would call like illegal news. And they came out with, you know, rumors and other kind of information, things the government didn't want you to hear. So very fascinating. And it was quite impressive how these things come about. And they became really daily newspapers printed from the capital. At the time, was Hangzhou in like southern China. It would be sent throughout China. And people read it, collected it. So it was really kind of fascinating. So we have a piece on that. And also Emily Seelove has written a piece about why she wrote a book of cartoons.
Nice.
It's called Popeye and Curly, 120 Days in Baghdad. So as last year, she started an Instagram putting in these cartoons. They're really kind of funny, kind of inspired by the stories of two kind of famous Baghdad writers. And she's kind of turned this into a comic book. So she talks about why she did that. And that's on the site this week.
That sounds awesome. We'll have to check that out. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support. You make the Medieval Podcast possible, so you have my eternal gratitude. Patrons can choose from all sorts of amazing stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our awesome maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from Trotta to troubadours, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books, including pre-ordering my new book, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.